This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So this next interview, you are going to really enjoy. It's with Brandon Bryant and Tonya Hessen-Shea. It was a real privilege for me to interview them. I'm hoping we're going to have a part two. We barely scratched the surface on a pretty serious issue. I guess Brandon's being called a whistleblower. You're going to have to dig in a little bit deeper, read the bio, check out the website, dronethedocumentary.com. It premieres in North America next Friday. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about drones. We talked about trust, and we talked about relationships and about war and things that matter, frankly. And I think you're going to be really impressed with Brandon and where he's landed. Check out the film. It's worth seeing for so many reasons. It's about becoming a better human, as corny as that may sound. Don't forget to check out davidpecklive.com, more podcasts there, and rabble.ca. Buckle up. It's a good interview. You're going to enjoy this one. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by two very special guests today, and I'm going to do my best to get Tonya's last name pronounced right. Tonya Hessen-Shea, is that good?
That sounds very good.
Excellent. And Brandon Bryan, thank you both for joining us today on Face to Face.
Thank you for having us.
So I think the audience is going to find out. They probably know a little bit about you already. They've read the bio. Maybe they've seen the film. We're going to talk about the website, I hope, as well. Let's get as much information out there as we can about this film. This is, Tonya, you've made this film Drone.
Yes.
Can you give me a minute on why, how do you get drawn into that? How do you get drawn into making a film about drones? Or is the question really, what is this film really about?
Well, I think for me, I got the idea in 2010 when I was working on my last film, Play Again. And in Play Again, I look at how kids in the States are growing up behind screens and spend most of their time in the virtual world. And I came across the story of a gamer who dropped out of high school, joined the military, and very quickly became a drone pilot with very little training. And to me, it was terrifying to think of how young kids go from getting points per kill to actually killing real people on the other side of the world. And this was, right as Obama was starting to ramp up the drone strikes in Pakistan. And I just got furious to see how he went from the promise of closing down Guantanamo to just simply killing thousands of people outside of the clear war zones with no transparency and no accountability, and the rest of the world just being silent. So that's how this film started.
So and please, Brandon, pop in wherever, because I've got some questions for you as well. But is this film really about drones, or is this a film about freedom? Is this a film about war? Is this a film about social justice? I mean, or is it about all of the above?
I think this film is basically about the CIA drone war, but broader. It's also about how our very culture is militarized, how our children are being prepared for war through gaming from a very young age, recruited by the military in this sort of never-ending war on terror that we have just gotten way too comfortable and used to, and not really questioning what the long-term consequences of what we're doing.
Brandon, do you feel that as a soldier you were militarized kind of at a young age? Were you sort of raised in a way that said that would make this an easy decision for you to get involved, to enlist?
Not actually. That's kind of the strange thing is I was raised away from war and conflict. I'm the first person in my family to join the military since World War II. I don't even think my grandfather, well, he was in the Air Force, great-grandfather, and he worked on the atomic bomb. But the rest of my family, we've never been militarized, small-town people. I kind of joined the military simply because I couldn't afford to go to school. And, of course, I was trying to impress a girl.
Why does it always come back to that, Brandon? That's what I want to know.
It's because it's, you know, hormones, I guess.
That's part of it.
Part of it. It has to do with the fact that we're not really raised to know what it is to be a man. And sometimes when we join the military, we think that that's how we're going to get our man card. But really, I've learned a lot over the last decade, actually, of my life dealing with this. I joined to, you know, for economic reasons. I ended up in a position where I had to do it. And I was raised by my great-grandfather and my mother. My mother was a teacher who raised me to be a critical thinker and love literature and a deep thinker, and my grandfather raised me to be a kind and loving man. And so I was raised right and forced into a military position, and I gave my word. And my grandfather told me once, he said, "The only thing that a man has of any worth in this world is your word, and if you cannot fulfill your word, then you have no worth." And so I did it anyway, regardless of how I felt, and I think that's kind of part of the reason why I have so much power, is because I did do my job and I did do it the right way.
So when you went in, you clearly went in with a conscience that said, I'm doing the right thing, I'm doing the noble thing, I've taken this oath, all sort of, you know, honorable notions, right? Honorable ideas about how to live as human beings, never mind men, but men and women, right?
Right.
And then during the process of your training, et cetera, and then the actual piloting of the drones, you came to some, was it an epiphany? Was it a moment? I mean, how do you come to that moral place where you go, okay, holy smokes, this is not right?
Well, it actually didn't feel right from the beginning, because they were trying to sensationalize it with us. When I first got into the program, I didn't know. They told us that they couldn't tell us what we were doing until we got there. And then when we got there, they showed like a montage video of drone strikes played with heavy metal music. And I like heavy metal music, so. But then after the video was over with, we had a sergeant come down and stand in front of us and says, "Your job is to kill people and break things." And they tried to make us seem like badasses and glorifying it. And I went to my commander and was like, "Sir, I don't think I can do this." And he was like, "You're property of the United States government. You swore an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. You will do your job." And, you know, goes back to giving my word. So I did it. And even up until the very point when I had my first strike, I was still questioning on whether or not I could do it. And, you know, I learned a pretty significant lesson that we make life cheap through this. A really cheap, almost worthless.
Tonya, I want to come back to a comment you made early on in the film, you know, the point and click. You know, I think your direct quote is, "It was, quote, it was point and click." And, you know, so disinterested. It sounds so detached. I mean, I grew up playing Asteroids and Space Invaders. Sorry, I'm showing my age, but I did. Those were kind of point and click, but not in the same way they are today that my son's growing up with and so on. So I want to come back to that, Brandon. But Tonya, what do you learn about truth? What do you learn about storytelling as a documentarian with regard to Brandon's story, to what's going on here, this kind of, you know, very interconnected web of lies, or at least so it seems?
Well, I think Brandon's voice in this is incredibly important. You know, for me, when I was going to make this film, I really wanted to tell the story of our new warriors, the drone pilots, you know, kind of get to the inside of what it means to kill with a joystick and what it means to be part of this new warfare. And it was incredibly hard to get access to the U.S. Air Force. And I had spent about a year, you know, calling the Pentagon and the Hollywood office of the U.S. Air Force.
Can you just call up the Pentagon? Can you just pick up the phone and call the Pentagon?
Yeah, they don't answer. They definitely didn't answer me.
You don't get through? Like, do you get voicemail? Like, what do you get?
You leave a voice message. And I started getting pretty creative in my messages.
I bet you did, yeah.
But right when I was in the midst of that, you know, Brandon spoke out in Der Spiegel. And it was something about Brandon's story that really moved me. And then I started to hunt Brandon down for quite some time. we used about 9 months to get to know each other, you know, mostly through social media. And then it's been an incredible honor to work with Brandon. To me, he's one of the bravest people we have today. And it's something, you know, for Brandon to speak out and to tell the truth, to break the lies and sort of deconstruct the notion that the drone war is the, you know, surgical, precise, perfect way to fight terrorism that is so incredibly important for people to hear and understand today.
So every comment leads to another question, but I want to get back to that as well, this surgical way of fighting terrorism. There's so much sort of, you know, the book 1984 by George Orwell, there's so much Orwellian newspeak that goes on. There's one interview you have with one of the, I think a senator, and I've got his name here, and I can't find it right now, but this, you know, the whole idea of a smart bomb, right? I mean, what exactly is a smart bomb, right? But so Brandon, somebody in the film talked about this dehumanization of the killing, you know, the point and click like nature of it. You're on a screen, and what really struck me was here's the quote: you never know who you are killing. You never see a human face. Do you think that had something to do with your, maybe you didn't have a shift because you say you always felt there was something not quite right about it. Do you think you have a problem with killing other people, or is it that you have a problem with killing other people that you can't see? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you told us earlier before the show that you're into philosophy.
Yes.
So war philosophy has been kind of a specialty that I've been studying for the last decade. And no matter what, everyone should have a problem with killing, even soldiers. The thing is that soldiers kill because it's necessary. Not because of what anyone else says, it's because there is it's a last moment thing. And it should be done with sorrow and regret every single time.
Mm, nice.
So what actually, the dehumanizing aspect, it didn't dehumanize these people. I don't know if you've ever heard of a game called The Sims. And it's kind of like that, where you just see people live out their lives day in and day out. You really have no control over what they're doing except for when you press the button to do action. And you're sitting there in a cold, dark box watching these people do their thing. And they're living their lives. We aren't. We're spending hours, 12 hours a day, doing nothing but watching these people. And so it made me feel less human, not the other people. They were really human. I saw everything. I saw men who had been planting bombs or shooting at other people come on play with their kids. Kids playing soccer, women cooking food and hanging clothes and doing what their culture has them do.
Don't you refer to yourself as the ultimate voyeur in the film?
Yeah, I do. And it's true. It's they're never going to know that we're there. And it's strangely perverted.
As a documentarian, Tonya, is it important to you tell a story that points to the truth, or to actually make sure you're telling the story in a truthful way. Does that make any sense? I know I saw a quote from Ken Burns recently, and he said, "Yeah, you know, I don't even care if the story's true," which I found, and I might be taking him out of context a little bit. But I guess what I mean is, and I think it echoes back to my earlier question of what is the movie really about? It's really not about drones, right? This is about freedom and about voyeurism. I mean, there's such a
humanity.
Long, yeah, exactly. It's about becoming better humans, isn't it? As corny as that might sound.
Well, I think that, you know, what is great about making a film is that everybody has their own perception of what is true and not true. And I think that, you know, everybody's going to have their own experience watching this film. I had my own experience, and to me, being a documentarian, I think that, you know, my how I see things to be true and how I make up my argument is what makes, you know, this film sort of my point of view, or my take on the situation, and then everybody else should, you know, see this and make it their own. I don't think there's one such thing as an objective truth, you know, when you talk about that. What's important to me is to tell a story that has touched my heart, and then hopefully, you know, in doing so, I will touch other people's hearts. And it has been just incredibly moving to see the responses that this film has gotten from school children and up to politicians here in Europe. So it's especially, you know, interesting and exciting to see how this film is going to be perceived in North America right now.
So yeah, you're currently in Norway doing kind of a high school tour, is that right?
Yes.
And the response has been inclusive and an embrace and very receptive.
It's been pretty incredible. It's been amazing. This amazing journey into all these small villages in the most beautiful area in Norway. Tons of high mountains and fjords, and the nature here is just, you know, mind-blowing.
Yeah, agreed.
So you're not...
Coming to this, like, small little local theaters, you know, where the teenagers have gathered, and they're just lit up, and they're ready, and they take it in, and especially for them to meet Brandon, and to see Brandon sort of light their eyes up. And, you know, we've had to just, you know, give a lot of hugs, and Brandon has taken a lot of selfies. Or not he, but everybody lines up to take their selfies with Brandon. So Brandon is an incredible storyteller, and how he reaches out to the kids has also been, you know, a great honor to be a part of and experience. So
you can't undervalue the huge, like, the splash and ripple effect, right? So they see your film on their own. That's great. They in a dark theater, they come away wondering, they can ask questions. They get it introduced by Brandon with Q&A afterwards and a selfie. That's the kind of life-changing moment I believe can make all the difference. Right, Brandon? It's the eye contact. It's a handshake. It's kind of the direct opposite of what you spent a few years doing in that box in the desert, right?
I mean, it's,
talk about a beautiful contradiction and paradox and irony of what's actually playing out here post-film. And so all these unexpected outcomes of all these people that you're meeting all over the world, I'm getting a shiver. Okay. I'm getting a shiver. It's cool. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's like one response that just seems to, you know, that we hear over and over again is that it's just, you know, thank you so much. We had no idea. Why did we not know about this? You know, we read the news, we, you know, keep on track of what's going on, but we had no idea, and with tears in their eyes. And that's been a very, very powerful experience.
But I think there's an assumption that in the West anyway, in Canada, in the U.S., and governments that supposedly work with the rule of law and, you know, an ethic of some kind, some sort of virtue ethic or a utilitarian ethic of some kind that says we behave in a certain way. And so I, as a citizen, when I see your film, I go, come on, that can't be really happening, is it? right? And so you have these moments where you go, this is an outrage, right? So it's the kind of thing as a filmmaker that must, you must see this kind of stuff a lot, Tonya, and say, there's something else I got to make a film about, right? I bet your list of films that you want to make is pretty long. That would be my sense.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the reasons why I went into documentaries to tell the stories that are being silenced or are not being told in mass media. And, yeah, there's a lot of things to choose from, for sure.
So, Brandon, here you are talking to the video game generation.
Correct.
On a stage. Lots, I guess mostly guys are playing these video games for the most part. I imagine there's some
you'd
women.
You'd be surprised. There's probably actually more girls that play video games than guys, but most of the guys play stuff like Call of Duty and Battlefield and the shooter type genres.
The I don't know who it was. I think his name Andy Von Floto, which is from your film, the drone maker, says mm-hmm. What was his line? Young men like to smash things.
Yeah.
So, in other words, I think everybody likes to smash things at some point. We all deal with anger of one kind or another. That doesn't mean you get into a box somewhere in the Nevada desert and shoot people, right?
Right.
There's a bit of a disconnect there, it seems to me.
Right. And I think that money has to do a huge part of it, greed. And when talking with these kids, I tell them, of course, I always tell them to don't get into debt and take responsibility for their own actions and to be more self-aware. I think that's incredibly important. But I think one thing that they might take for granted that I remind them of is I was alive and growing up when the internet first started, and they're more interconnected now than I ever was. And everyone's the same behind a keyboard. Doesn't matter if your religion, race, sexuality, gender, creed. Everyone's the same. Everyone can express an opinion. And I always make sure that they understand the fact that they're going to vote for people to represent them in government at some point. And they're the ones that are supposed to take orders from them, not the other way around. Don't let them put fear into you. Don't let the media, don't let the politicians, don't let their religion, don't let anyone else tell them that something wrong is something right. And I think that's they take a hold on to that.
I think this idea, you know, what you just said is really, as a fellow philosopher, right? I mean, you sound like a bit of an existentialist, right? Responsibility, freedom, choice. Take responsibility for your own actions. Choose, move forward. And, you know, as Kierkegaard says, you're only going to understand it when you look back, right? And then you see the dots. Then you see things, how they connect, how they start to make sense. How do you take responsibility as a soldier for your own actions? Because isn't that kind of the beauty of being a soldier, that you don't have to? How do you, you clearly stood up. You fought back. How do you do that in that environment?
Well, it's really difficult because everyone wants to diffuse responsibility. Like, I mean, look at history. Look at the Nuremberg trials. People were tried simply for following orders. That's been a historical landmark. And we can't go back on that. We can't just say, oops, I was following orders. And they kind of try to diffuse responsibility by saying, well, orders come from the highest echelon. Orders come from this part. Well, we still carry out the actions. We are still responsible for our actions, regardless of who gives us the orders. And I think a lot of people confuse warrior with soldier.
Mm.
They're completely two different things. A soldier can be a warrior. But a warrior is not necessarily a soldier. You know, warriors in ancient past, warrior philosophy was understanding the spiritual, physical, and psychological nature of war to prevent war. Sun Tzu's The Art of War says, the best battle that is fought is one that isn't fought. And even Sun Tzu's The Art of War is supposed to be required reading for all military members. I would actually hope that the Iliad and the Odyssey would be required as well. And it's things like this, the devaluing of intellect, the devaluing of choice, the glorification of it. You know, because soldiers, they don't want to know that what they've done is wrong. They want to know what they've done is for glory, for honor, for protection of others. And once you start questioning that, it really, that is them. That is us. We do that. We live for fighting. We live for the battle. And when it is not healthy, when it is not right, and we question it, that's when you get the numbers that are happening right now in America of 22 veterans a day killing themselves. And it's horrible. And I've talked to soldiers from other countries, and they're not getting the help that they need as well. And they're questioning what's going on. And we have, our political system is really screwed up. We have like less than 2%, I think, of our congressional body that has actually had military experience, and they're the ones sending us to war.
Right.
That shouldn't happen. That should not happen. We should have more military veterans in congressional political positions. We should have journalists in political positions. We should have the people that actually care about these matters beyond the fact that they're getting a paycheck.
Our Canadian government just put a Minister of Defense into place who's actually served in Afghanistan, and I'm not sure that, I mean, fairly recently as well. So it's, you know, and I got to say, I'm just going to put a little Canadian plug in here. I think we have, as a result of our recent election, I think we have 184 new members of Parliament who had not been in Parliament before. Now, that's no question a liability on some levels, but I think it's also an indicator that change can occur, right?
Well,
you know, that people can say, I've had enough of this, and I want something else. I want something different. There is a reason. We had our highest voter turnout in history, in recent history. And so things can change.
Well, that's kind of incredible because I think less than 30% of the American population voted in our last election. And I'm going to kind of disagree with you on the lack of parliamentary experience. I think that we need people like teachers and scientists and veterans and journalists in these positions, especially after they've had their experience. We shouldn't have people go to be politicians.
Right, right.
Learn to simply
yeah.
be politicians.
No, I'm with you there. I guess my point was is that here we got 184 new, over half of them are new, right? They've never been here, but they're not professional politicians. Right?
That's good.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think you're absolutely right. Because what you're saying is you're gaining experience from other perspectives, other worldviews, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I think humanity is strong in its diversity. I think like that's kind of the funny thing about like all these governments who want to, you know, we have this Trans-Pacific Partnership and all these things that are trying to put everything under one cohesive banner. But that gets rid of the strength of humanity. Like, everyone has different experiences. Everyone's lived in different places, experienced different things, and that's where we get our strength. And as soon as we understand that, I think that's where we'll get them forward, especially since we're so connected now.
Tonya, you know, D.W. Griffith said that the purpose of filmmaking was to make you see. That's what he wanted to do as a filmmaker back in the early 1900s. Is that why you wanted to make documentaries? I've heard some documentarians say, you know what, I make movies for myself. I see an issue, I have a passion about it, I want to make it for myself. I'm not getting that sense from you. Certainly not in this conversation anyway. You know,
For me, I always think about trying to reach the most amount of people that I can. I mean, I make films because I feel like I have something important to share, and stories that need to be told that, you know, everybody should know about or see or hear and feel. And especially the young audience is very interesting to me. So I think, you know, in my films, I always strive to make films that appeal to the young audience, as well as, you know, older people as well. But it's something about reaching out to youth that is especially important to me.
She's an educator at heart.
Would you guys describe yourselves as, I would agree with that, would you guys describe yourselves as hopeful cynics?
I would say that I'm an optimistic realist, actually. I believe in the greater good, and I believe in our higher purpose. And I've been through some pretty bad things. I've lost friends and family over this issue. I've I've lost brothers and sisters, better fellow veterans who have threatened to kill me because of whatever reason. But I still, I just believe it's because they're hurt and they don't want to question things. And my grandfather, kindest and gentlest man that I'd ever met, and he taught me a lot. I mean, the old wife, and you know, in everyone's story. And the thing that I learned from him the most is that love is actually extremely powerful. And you're not going to do anything if you don't care about it. You're not going to protect something if you don't love it. And the very definition of love is to give it to someone who doesn't, you feel doesn't deserve it. So, I love my country. I do. And my country isn't represented by my government, it's my people. And my brothers and sisters are being sent to war for the wrong purposes. They're being misused and abused, and I love them. Regardless of however they feel about me, I love them. And I don't want to see my brothers and sisters be broken and come home damaged and kill themselves and be discarded by the system that says that they would take care of them. And I think that's really the message behind what I feel is that regardless of how bad things get, love is always going to win.
Yeah, I mean, how do you top that? I think that might be a pretty good place to wrap up the interview. I mean, I'd like to sit here and talk to you guys all day, honestly. I mean, maybe we can do a part two after the film airs. Is that a possibility?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I just so appreciate your generosity, both of you, and I know the audience, Rabble, and my audience are going to as well. And so tell us real quick. So premiering, North American premiere next week, New York City. You guys are going, or you've been on tour, but you've got some touring to do still, right?
Yeah, we're going straight from Norway to New York City.
Okay.
And it's going to be a very, very exciting week. We can't say much more than that, but we highly recommend that people stay tuned and follow us on Facebook. All kinds of things are going to happen. Drone documentary. Our premiere is on Friday, the 20th. That's 7 o'clock at the AMC Theater on Times Square.
Fantastic. And the website is dronethedocumentary.com.
Dronedocumentary.com, yeah.
And it's my 30th birthday when we premiere this film.
Oh,
so,
come on. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's nice. A good coincidence.
What did you get him for his birthday, Tonya?
The premiere of the film.
It has not been yet. It is a surprise.
It's a surprise.
But, you know, it's looking like a good celebration.
I bet it will be. Hey, thanks so much for joining us today, Brandon Bryant, Tonya Hesenche. Yes?
Yes.
S&J, sorry. I'm so sorry, Tonya.
Totally okay.
Thank you so much, guys, for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.